Welcome to NPR's Movie Podcast, the best of NPR love for the movies. This week, we go to Africa for the closing of Kenya's last drive-in. We'll hear a remembrance for Betsy Blair and Natasha Richardson. And we pay tribute to two NPR programs that shut down production for good this week with a News and Notes conversation with Jada Pinkett Smith, and from Day to Day, an interview with the writer of the screenplay for the film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. A full plate this week, and we start it all off with Kenneth Turan reviewing Duplicity. Take it away, Kenny.
The only thing you can trust about Duplicity is its title. It's a throwback to the days of old-school caper movies like To Catch a Thief. It's also just the kind of sophisticated amusement you would expect from filmmaker Tony Gilroy. Gilroy wrote the script for The Bourne Identity. In Duplicity, he's done a lighter version of his previous Michael Clayton. Back we go to the dog-eat-dog world of corporate malfeasance and industrial espionage. Only this time, it's played for laughs and romance. Julia Roberts is a CIA officer, and Clive Owen is an MI6 agent. They've decided to go private and run an elaborate scam that takes advantage of a war between rival corporations.
Can you imagine living like this? How much fun we could have?
Aren't we in enough trouble?
I mean, having the money.
Keep going.
How much do you think we'd need?
20 million?
I was thinking 40.
So what do you have to do to get $40 million?
Go private. Be smart. Get lucky.
How smart?
Smart enough to pick the right partner.
The question is, can they trust each other enough to allow that to happen? Even if you beg, I'm not going to tell you anymore. All I'll say is that Duplicity's plotting is dazzlingly complex, full of turns inside of twists and twists inside of turns. It makes your head spin like an amusement park ride you can barely hang on to, something that needs to be experienced to be appreciated. Aside from Roberts and Owen, the real star here is Tony Gilroy, a writer-director with a gift for updating classic Hollywood with smart and sophisticated contemporary touches. He's written fine dialogue of all sorts, from repartee to romance to comedy and tension, and he's directed with snap, energy, and playfulness. Everything in Duplicity may be a scam, but Gilroy's talent is the real thing.
It was Gloria Swanson, playing faded film star Norma Desmond in Sunset Boulevard, who insisted that she was still big, the pictures had gotten small. Well, as NPR's Gwen Tompkins reports, they're even about to get small in Nairobi, Kenya.
There sure is a handsome moon tonight. It's just a crescent, really, but no less illuminating than a well-placed comma in a line of verse. Here, on the outskirts of Nairobi, the stars are out, and the crickets, and frogs, of course. Makes you miss childhood when frogs were everywhere. But on a night like this, in a place like this, you can buy a ticket to another era at the last outdoor picture show. The Fox is the last drive-in movie theater in Kenya, aside from the makeshift screens that people jimmy together on the sides of buildings. This is a proper drive-in, built just after World War II, with box office toll booths, a long curving driveway, an expanse of green, and a brigade of upright speakers that look like something that Gary Cooper might have tied his horse to. The screen, 120 feet by 70, the kind of screen that makes you think of searchlights crisscrossing the sky, of horses galloping after a stagecoach, of John Ford and Cecil B. DeMille and Barbara Stanwyck, who really knew how to walk across a room. Major Michael Kinua manages operations for the drive-in and other Fox theaters in the country. He remembers seeing a rerun of The Ten Commandments on this screen in the late 1970s, relaxing with his honey in the back seat of a sedan.
I came with friends, with our girlfriends. Here in your car, you can hold, you can hug, you know, you have all the freedom of your car.
Back then, people did a fair amount of canoodling on a night like this, under a moon like this, a kissing moon. And some things don't change, but the Fox certainly has. During colonial times, Kinua and his pals would never have gotten in. only white patrons came here, and most were British servicemen and their sweethearts or families. With independence in 1963, the rest of Kenya came to sit under the stars. Arabs, Somalis, black people, and Kenyans of South Asian descent. Dinesh Harani wants to be a star. He resembles the actor Ben Gazzara, and at age 47, Harani says he wants to break into pictures.
Because I go to the gym, I look young, you see. Go, if I dye my hair, and you know, if they put a nice effect on the lightening and everything, makeup, you look more young. You look even 30 years old on the screen.
Truth is, there aren't enough Dinesh Haranis at the Fox. Slowly, slowly, as the Kenyans say, business has dropped off. Tonight, the Great Lawn is virtually empty. The road outside is one of the area's busiest, but only 9 cars occupy a space that can hold more than 500. 20th Century Fox sold its interest years ago, and now the movies that play here are exclusively Bollywood, straight from Mumbai. But it's better to see them than to hear them. How's this for a hearing test? Major Kinyua says the movie tonight is in English. But you might notice that the movie is in Hindi. Understand the problem? Isaac Musina is a black Kenyan who's been the projectionist here for nearly 40 years. He's learned to love Bollywood movies, even though he doesn't speak a word of Hindi. Musina dances between 2 enormous projectors that look like what Orson Welles might have leaned on for inspiration. The room is immaculate, with fans whirring and tubes of cool water coursing through the machines to keep the celluloid from melting onto the spools. Giant reels the size of extra-large pizza pies turn, making the 35mm film go... Musina watches the print closely. He's waiting for a signal that comes onto the screen, letting him know it's time to fire up the other projector with a new reel. Call it the secret language of projectionists. Most people don't notice.
It's a small dot on the right side.
At intermission, Kalpna Bhandari bypasses the gleaming candy stand and walks her 2 children back to the cafeteria, where they can get hot, thick French fries and, unfortunately, thin ketchup. Her kids are 7 and 9 years old, and frankly, you wouldn't want to sit next to them in a movie theater. Neither does she.
So it's better, you know, if they want to misbehave, they can misbehave in the car. Like theaters, they can't make noise. Yeah, they can't make noise. They have to sit in one place. So drivers are better.
But 9 cars and French fries won't pay the light bill at the Fox, or the workers, or the minimum $3,000 that it costs to get a film from India past customs and approval from the Kenya Film Censorship Board. Not when hawkers on the streets of Nairobi don't pay taxes at all. The hawkers sell black market DVDs of the latest releases for about $4 apiece. And there are sometimes 25 movies on a single DVD. That's partly why the folks who own the Fox Drive-In are going to tear it down. They've got prime real estate out here that could be making them a lot more money. In the coming months, they're planning residential housing, a mall, and yes, a 6-screen Cineplex. The future of the entertainment business in Kenya is apparently indoors. But who knows? Maybe they'll paint some stars on the ceiling and a great big kissing moon. Gwen Tompkins, NPR News, Nairobi.
The neon lights on Broadway were dimmed at 8 Thursday night to honor the memory of Tony Award-winning actress Natasha Richardson. She died at the age of 45 after an accident at a Canadian ski resort. The British-born actress left behind a substantial body of work, and it was reported in the obituaries that Richardson was planning to star with her mother, Vanessa Redgrave, in a Broadway revival of Stephen Sondheim's A Little Night Music. Natasha Richardson was not quite born with a script in her hand, but had an impressive pedigree. The Redgraves have been in the theater for generations. Her mother, Vanessa Redgrave, is also well known for her political outspokenness and activism. Although she's encountered strong protests, her career continues to flourish. I thought about Redgrave when I read about the death of an actress whose career was cut short because of her political beliefs. The obituary appeared in the paper the same day as Redgrave's daughter's. Betsy Blair died in London at the age of 85. Chances are you may only remember her because she was nominated for an Oscar. She played Ernest Borgnine's girlfriend in the 1955 film Marty. Blair almost didn't get the job. She was born in New Jersey. She began as a dancer, first in a Times Square night spot where she met the choreographer, Eugene Curran Kelly. She was 17. They married. They moved to Hollywood. He became Gene Kelly, and Hollywood was their oyster. During their 16-year marriage, one she described as happy, Blair became involved in political causes. She worked on behalf of the NAACP and the Independent Progressive Party. At one point, she wanted to join the Communist Party, but was not admitted. Her husband wasn't a member, and he was considered too famous. But she was put on Hollywood's blacklist. Her career dried up. But through Gene Kelly's intervention, she was cast in Marty. The next year, she left him and went to Europe. She divorced him in 1957, made a few movies in Europe, and married the Czech-born director Karl Reiss. Blair went on to become a speech therapist in London, and she had no regrets about anything. Over the years, Blair was asked why she chose to end her storybook marriage to Gene Kelly, a man she described as the perfect husband, father, friend, protector, provider, hard worker, a man she said she loved and admired as a brilliant actor and dancer, as well as a good, good man. In one interview, she said it had nothing to do with sex. It was freedom.
Gotta dance, gotta dance, gotta dance, gotta dance.
Actor, singer, songwriter, and director are just some of the titles associated with Jada Pinkett Smith. In a career that started almost 20 years ago with roles on TV shows such as True Colors, 21 Jump Street, and A Different World, Jada Pinkett Smith has gone on to star in blockbuster movies, including The Matrix sequels, Set It Off, Ali, and Collateral. Younger film fans also know her as the voice of Gloria in Madagascar. Now, Jada Pinkett Smith is adding another string to her artistic bow as executive producer on the soon-to-be-released medical drama Hawthorne on TNT. She also plays the lead character. Jada Pinkett Smith, welcome to News and Notes. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Oh, thank you so much.
We're going to talk about Hawthorne in a moment, but I have to ask you this because I read this about you. I want to know if it's true. Were you really named for a soap opera star?
That's what my mother says. So, you know, she was a young mother. She had me at 18. So one of, I think, her favorite character on the soap opera, her real name was Jada. And that's what she named me.
Oh, that's, it's a beautiful name.
But well,
that's a great story.
Thank you.
Talking about names, let's talk about Christina Hawthorne.
Sure.
That's the new character on your show, Hawthorne, which you are the executive producer of and also the lead. What's that story about?
The show itself is about everyday people who do extraordinary things, and we're focusing on a community of nurses in this hospital. And it's a dramedy. And where most medical shows, they focus on, you know, some type of medical crisis, we really focus on the lives of people surrounding a medical crisis. Not necessarily the medical crisis itself, but the emotional impact and the private lives of patients that come in. So not only are these nurses trying to heal some physical aspect of the patient, but they're also trying to heal some an aspect of their soul through their interaction. And you know, my mother's a nurse. She was a nurse. She was an RN. And that a huge part, and having been in the hospital before, a huge part of nursing is caretaking of the soul as well. So basically that's what the show
is about.
Really is about.
What's Christina like? Are we going to like her? Is she tough like all the other women who now have shows on TNT, like Kara Sedgwick and Holly Hunter? She's tough, broad.
Well, you know, she's got a lot of heart. She really does. I mean, she's a woman who is head of all the nursing of this particular facility. So she's a woman that's about her business, but at the same time, she's a really open, funny, loving person. She's also dealing with a tragedy of her own. She's a widow. She just lost her husband to cancer, and she's trying to raise a teenage daughter. I would say, is she a a strong woman, yes, but I wouldn't say she's tough in the sense of, like, macho or even in how people have seen me before. I think it will definitely be a different side of, not necessarily Jada, but see a different character, probably that I haven't really played.
Something new.
Something new.
All right, we're talking with Jada Pinkett. Let me ask you this, Jada, because you don't appear to have any bias towards working in television. Obviously, you're going to do this new show on TNT. Some actors, though, have in the past. And my question is this. What has changed about working in TV? Is it just to be able to work, or is it being creative? Is it keeping one's name out there, or maybe because of cable there's more freedom now?
Well, you know, for me, it wasn't any of those things. For me, I felt it was an opportunity for me to grow producerially, and I felt like it was an opportunity for me to grow creatively. TV has a certain pace and a certain grind that, for my personality, I need. And so I felt like it was a great opportunity for me to sharpen my storytelling skills, because every week we have to deliver a fantastic script. So it puts you into the fire. I felt like 3 months out of the year, I really loved the schedule of cable, and it allowed me to be in the lab intensively for 3 months out of the year, and then I have the rest of the year to do whatever I want.
You've done a million different things. You were in Collateral, Menace to Society, of course. You were Gloria in Madagascar, Lena James back in A Different World, all these different things that you've done. And I have read that you and your husband have a philosophy about acting. I want to ask you about that. And it's this, the connecting with an audience on an emotional level, how important that is, and how are you able to do that?
Well, I feel like connecting with, you know, all audiences, you know, because I've also had a metal band. I've also done comic books, and I've also done Flash for I Am Legend and comic books for I Am Legend. For me, I like diving into all different areas in which and relating to people. And I feel like, to me, art is a ladder to God, in my own opinion, you know. And so for me, if the more people that I can reach through many different artistic avenues, the better. It's very important to erase those boundaries, especially in dealing with in a creative world. And because I'm an African-American woman, it's even more important that for me, that black women are given the respect and are given the opportunity to make choices of what lanes we decide we want to be in, and that nobody is dictating those lanes for us.
You know, you took a great big eraser, Jada Pinkett, to those ideas with Wicked Wisdom, didn't
yes.
you? I mean, when I saw that video of you, I was like, oh my God, that's Jada Pinkett singing rock, metal rock. Is that, am I saying it right?
Yeah, metal.
Now, let's talk about you, Jada Pinkett, the person. Born in Maryland, apparently your grandmother played a big part in getting you into the business, like a lot of black folks' grandmothers
yeah.
did. You're a singer, director, songwriter, actress, dancer, producer, wife, mother, philanthropist, granddaughter, daughter. Which of those is first for you?
I would say the one that is first is being Jada, is the woman. In order for me to do all of those things, I have to be very clear on who I am, you know,
mm-hmm.
and have a lot of, I don't know, just confidence in what I'm doing and just in who I'm being. That has to be first and foremost in order to facilitate all of those areas.
You know, sort of like being on an airplane when they tell you when that air mask drops down in case of an emergency.
That's right.
Put your mask on first.
That's right.
I'm feeling. Let me ask you this, because you're in the spotlight in a major way, both with your own career and particularly because of your relationship with Will.
Right.
Do you feel dogged at all in terms of this public responsibility or lack of, as far as your personal life is concerned, when there are always things in the press about you and about Will and about Scientology and about the school that you established and what's being taught there and the kind of marriage that you have and the relationships that you have with each other and other people, perhaps. Does this dog you, this kind of interest?
You know what? Not really. You know, I definitely respect and understand people's curiosity, you know, mm-hmm. and but people, they have to trust me when I speak on my truth. That's really the bottom line. And so if you're dealing with people, if I say to you, I don't have an open marriage, no, we're not gay, you know, then, and you don't trust that, well, then there's nothing that I really have to say to anybody about anything, because at the end of the day, I'm living my life and I'm happy. I definitely want to make it very clear to everybody that the educational institution that we have, the school that Will and I have, is not a Scientology school. And that, you know, I know there's been, you know, a lot of buzz around that idea, and that it is not my desire to, you know, teach Scientology at all. And that the method of teaching in which we use, you know, is a product of L. Ron Hubbard, which a lot of schools in L.A. use that are not affiliated with Scientology at all. So I just need your audiences to know that it is not a desire of ours to educate children with Scientology. That is not what Will and I want to do. Our school is not, and I repeat, not a Scientology school.
That's about as clear, I think, as it can be made, wouldn't you say?
I think so.
I once interviewed your husband, actually. This is a number of years ago, back during his Fresh Prince days. What struck me about Will on that particular day was how much he seemed to really enjoy what he was doing.
Yeah.
Is that true of you, too, that you really like this?
Yeah. We love what we do. We, you know, creation is part of our life. Like, we love, 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 love to create. And I feel so blessed that I found a partner that understands that part of me and can share that with me, and, you know, understands the business and all of the ins and outs of that. I don't know if I could have had a partner that was outside of my creative life.
Final thing is this. You've been involved politically over the last several months, for sure. I'm not sure how far back it goes. I know that you were supportive of the Obama campaign, and I've read that you would love to play Michelle Obama. Now, Jada Pinkett, how are you going to play Michelle Obama? She's almost 6 feet tall.
Well, I've always said it would be a dream. I never said it would happen. I never said it would happen, but, you know, I really love Michelle, and I find her to be an extraordinary woman.
Jada Pinkett Smith, it has been a wonderful time talking. I could talk to you all day long, but I know you've got to go make some money, and I've got to go try to find another job. So it's wonderful talking to you.
I'm glad we had this opportunity.
Thank you very much. Good luck with Hawthorne. We'll be watching.
Thank you so much.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Be well.
That was actor, songwriter, and director Jada Pinkett Smith. Her new medical drama, Hawthorne, will air on TNT beginning in June.
And now a story about one of my favorite endings ever. It's from the 1971 film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Like the Roald Dahl book it was based on, the movie tells the story of five kids who win a chance to tour Willy Wonka's amazing chocolate factory. At the very end, just one child, Charlie, is left on the tour.
How did you like the chocolate factory, Charlie?
I think it's the most wonderful place in the whole world.
I'm very pleased to hear you say that, because I'm giving it to you.
Mel Stewart directed the film. He hired a young documentary maker named David Seltzer to write the screenplay. Seltzer had never written a script before. So he flew to Munich, where they were filming, and over the course of a few sleepless weeks, he furiously cranked out a screenplay. In its first draft, David Seltzer kept the ending just as it was in the book. And then, utterly exhausted, Seltzer left Germany and went to relax for a while in a tiny cabin tucked away in the woods of Maine.
There were no phones up there except for one payphone that was literally tacked to a tree. And when somebody needed somebody in the area, chances are no one would be around to hear it. Early one morning, I was going out fishing, and I happened to be walking by that spot. The phone is ringing. And I picked it up, and it's Mel Stewart in Munich. He said, where the hell are you? We need you. We need to talk to you. I said, well, you can talk to me, but I'm kind of way far away, Mel. And he said, we don't have an ending to the movie.
Because at that point, the ending was what was in the book, which is where Willy Wonka and Charlie and Charlie's grandpa are in this glass elevator shooting up. And I think the last word was like, yippee.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's exactly how the book ended. And Mel said, are you kidding me? All this trouble we've gone to make this movie, all the money that's gone into it, all the talent, the musical numbers, the choreography, the Oompa Loompas, it ends with the word yippee. He said, that's not a screenplay. That's not a movie. You can't do that.
So what did you do?
I said, well, let me think about it. You know, how long do I have? He said, how long? We're standing here. It's $30,000 an hour. You tell me. And I said, well, give me a second. And I think it was about 6 in the morning. And I walked out and literally looked over the lake in Maine. I thought, what the hell am I going to do? My headspace was totally out of this movie. I could barely remember what had led up to this. But I thought, okay, it's a fairy tale. It's a children's story. And how do children's stories end? I don't know. How do they end? They end with they all lived happily ever after, but that's not good. That's not what a screenwriter writes. So I took a deep swallow and I went to the phone. I said, Mel, okay, listen carefully. They're going up in the spaceship and looking at the ground disappear, and Willy Wonka announces to Charlie that the chocolate factory is his. Then Willy Wonka looks at him and he says, but Charlie, in a very cautious voice, you do know what happened to the little boy who suddenly got everything he ever wanted, don't you? And fear comes across Charlie's face, and he says, no, what? And Willie says, he lived happily ever after. And there was a long pause, and I thought, my career as a screenwriter is over. I said, Mel, are you there? And he said, fantastic. And that was it.
And that's it. That's the end of the movie.
That's the end of the movie.
David Seltzer, since then, you have written plenty of other films and TV shows. I'm curious, you know, when you go about writing an ending now, is there anything that you take from that experience into your writing now?
Well, I do. Number one, an ending is possibly the most important thing because the exit polls, how an audience feels leaving the movie, will either encourage or discourage more box office. I learned the hard way on a couple of movies that audiences don't want to be bummed out. Characters they have come to know and love and root for, they don't want to see them lose at the end. And so I do apply a lot of thought as to how not to totally sell out, but at the same time leave the audience with an experience that's uplifting, that's positive, that they want to go home and talk about, that they want to bond over, that they can really get to know each other better by discussing.
So with that in mind, we're not a film, we're a radio show, but we are coming to an end. But we do want to leave our listeners with a happy ending of sorts. Can you offer some advice about how to write an ending here?
Obviously, that's why you brought me here today. But I have only the same thing to offer. They all lived happily ever after. That's you. That's your crew. That's everybody who does all this good work in spite of this particular moment in time. You shall.
David Seltzer wrote the screenplay to Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Thank you.
Thank you.
But Charlie, don't forget what happened to the man who suddenly got everything he always wanted.
What happened?
He lived happily ever after.
For more about these and other movies, visit our website, npr.org/movies.